All right, back to center. So let's grab our Bibles. Hop in with me to the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes. Also, in your bulletin, you should have a study notes, some notes. And I'm going to encourage you each week, grab a bulletin, pick it up, follow along, because you're going to want this not only for your group time if you're in a Next Step group, but you're also going to want it because we're going to cover quite a bit of content each week. Most weeks when I teach, I do so by reading a chunk of text, and then we explain it pretty much all together. Ecclesiastes almost prohibits us from doing it that way. Rather, we're going to read a section, talk, kind of go a little bit more verse by verse, and so I think this will be, I hope at least, a useful tool for you. One of the weird things about being not just a parent, but being human is all the questions that we come up with in life. Have you noticed some of the questions we come up with? I mean, there are all sorts of them. We ask what time it is, where we'll eat, what we will wear, what the weather is doing, how our favorite sports team is doing. We ask all sorts of questions. But it is especially acute, I think, often for parents because of the kinds of questions they hear their children raise. Any parents in the house? Any questions that you've heard even this week from your kids? Raise your hand, let me see them. Like three of you. Can we swap kids? And so they're asking all these kind of questions. Now, there's some that are related to God and the nature of God. In fact, I ran across a few that I just thought were too good not to share. And so these are some questions that kids ask about God. One kid asks, why did God make mosquitoes? They just bite. They don't do anything of value. Why, and I quote, why, God, why did you make mosquitoes? Anyone else wonder why mosquitoes? Man, little bloodsuckers, right? Maybe it's to give us an illustration of children. Okay, anyway, number two. Second question. One child asked, did Jesus get body trained as quickly as I got potty trained? Third one. A mom once shared with a group of people because of her three-year-old child. One day they were outside and they saw a bird's nest and a little bird had fallen out of the nest. And so the mom, being very thoughtful, quickly scooped up the bird, put it in a plastic bag, and threw it away in the trash. And so then later her three-year-old daughter said, Mommy, what happened to the bird? And the mom just, you know, says, well, honey, the little bird has gone home to be with Jesus. And the girl looked at her mom very thoughtfully and said, so you're telling me Jesus lives in the trash? Evidently, she saw the little bird. And then my favorite is a little boy asked, if Jesus doesn't have a sister, why do I need a sister? But there are all these questions that we ask about life, and some of them are very small and trite and silly. There are others that are bigger, more meaningful, and often not as easily answered. In fact, any thinking person is going to run headfirst into some large questions if they live for any length of time. And that's why we have the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is a part of five books considered the wisdom literature. So you have Job dealing with the nature of suffering. You have Psalms, which are both praise, but also questions of how do we work through and talking to God in the midst of suffering. You have Proverbs, a collection of wisdom phrases on how to live well and live right and live wisely. You have Song of Solomon. Oh, I mean, that's the one about love and sex and marriage and pursuit and how do you do this well. And then you have Ecclesiastes, which asks big questions and often does not give us answers. Rather, much of the rest of the Bible is for the answers. And so we come to Ecclesiastes, and I love what Herman Melville said. He's the author of Moby Dick. He said that Ecclesiastes is the truest of all books. In fact, you really can't trust a person who's never gone through some suffering, who's never dealt with difficulties. But it's those who've gone through the fire, who even on the other side may not have answers, but have come through. Those are the people whose information, whose experience you really want to have. And so Solomon, we think, begins and he writes this to us. So let's look here, beginning in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. The first three verses are really introduction to this entire book. Verse 1 reads this way: the words of, now notice this, the teacher. Now, the word Ecclesiastes comes from the word Koheleth, the Hebrew word Koheleth. And that word can be translated the preacher or the teacher. It's really just one who assembles. I heard one scholar say, because of the nature of this book, perhaps the best way to translate it is not preacher or teacher, but the philosopher. Someone who has life experience but asks these big existential questions. How life works. Why do bad things happen to seemingly good people? Why is it that the wicked prosper but the good people go without? What is the meaning of life? How do we deal with pain? How do we deal with God? All these big questions. And so he says, the words of the teacher. And I like the NIV's rendition because a teacher is someone who has something to share with you. He wants us to understand some things about the nature of life. This is the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, there are all sorts of questions as to who this is. It used to be universally assumed that Solomon was the writer of Ecclesiastes. In recent years, that has been called into question. Honestly, I don't tend to find all the evidence overly convincing, and so I tend to think that it's still Solomon. But whether it's Solomon or not, this is someone who has great experience, someone who is very wise and knows life. And in fact, when you think about the one who's going to give us these questions, who better to ask them than Solomon? He had more wealth than you or I will ever have. He had more power than you or I will ever have. He had more wives than you or I will ever have. 700 wives. And the Bible says he's the wisest person who ever lived, I think because he had so many mothers-in-law offering advice. So he is the perfect candidate to give us these questions, to ask the big questions of life. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless. Now, these are really important words. In fact, this is going to be his thesis statement for the entire book. Meaningless, meaningless. Some of your translations will say what? Vanity. But these words come from this little Hebrew word, hebel. It's used 38 times in 12 chapters. Do you think he wants us to get the point that everything is meaningless? The word actually best described or translated is vapor or smoke. The idea that life is like this thing you try to hold on to, but you can't hold on to it. And when you try to make sense of it, when you think that it's solid, that it has some form, it has some certainty, you grab on, but you do, and it kind of. And so the things you hold on to, you think, oh, this is good, this is meaningful. Like smoke, you can't hold on to it. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Now, what is meaningless? What's that next word? Everything. It's not just this is meaningless or that is meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Verse 3, he goes on to say, what does a man gain? This word is really important. It's the word profit. In fact, if I were to ask you what is profit, if we were to talk about it, some people might say, I'm not sure how to define it. Here's the best way. You will get a check at the end of the month, or maybe twice a month, if you are working. I remember the first time I ever got my first, like, real person check. I was working in college at a shoe store. It was a fine Italian leather shoe store. I hated every minute. And I remember the first check I got, I was like, I get real money for real people. And I look at my check, and I start reading, wait, I'm getting this, but FICA is getting all of that. Who is FICA and why is he stealing my money? And of course, that is all the taxes and employment and all the things they take out of your money. And so it's not my money. And then it said, this is how much I thought I had, but this is how much I really have. And then I have these things called bills. Anyone ever heard of bills before? I hate Bill and all of his friends, bills. And so you take out all the bills and you pay for everything and your profit is what you have left. After everything is spent after everything is used up. And he's saying, what does a man gain? What is his profit in life? Because from all his labors, here in life, at the end of life, what do you have left to show for your work? What is that which is left over when you are dead, painted like a clown, and put in the ground? What's left? And then he makes this qualifying phrase, at which he toils, notice this now, three words, under the sun. He's going to ask the question, what meaning is there to life, not just any life, but life under the sun? And here's what that phrase means. Life without God. Because there's two places you can live. You can live life under the sun, the idea that there's only this world, there's only this life, there's only what we see, taste, touch, feel, the senses rule, or just maybe there's something above and beyond the sun. And so what he's going to do is for the next umpteen chapters, he's going to say, here's what life under the sun looks like if there is nothing. Hear me now. Look right at me. If there is nothing beyond this life, here's what we have left to work with. And I love, he is such a good philosophy professor. He's such a good teacher that he's already anticipated. He's already ready for the arguments people are going to present. It's sort of like, again, as a parent, I don't have a lot of experience in life except for being a parent, so that's what I draw from. There are moments you will tell your children, you cannot have a cookie right now. And the first thing they want to know is, why? By the way, I have a theory that no person after the fourth why is able to give a good answer. Why can I not? Because. Well, why that? Because. Why that? Because. And on the fourth one, because I. And you become your mom and your dad in that moment. And so they say, why? But Solomon, he's ready for the big why. Or how about? And before the objections can be raised, he knocks down three common 21st century answers to where you can find meaning without a God. And so here we go. We're just going to kind of knock through these. Now, because these can be a little heady and a little bit more, maybe not what we run in typically, I've got a little music for you this morning as well to see if you can kind of feel or groove with me as to what these three are. But here's the very first one he's going to knock down. The very first argument saying, yes, we can have meaning on earth without God. The very first one is this. It's called humanism. More precisely, secular humanism. Now you go, I have no idea what that means. Here's a very brief, and again, I'm having to be so condensed. This is a very brief, not very nuanced definition, but here it is basically. Secular humanists say that even without God, you can have meaning. Go ahead and do this next slide. You can have meaning in making the world a better place. We'll just leave it better than it is right now. Or by leaving a legacy, we'll do something great and people will remember us for years and years to come. Now, you may go, I'm not real sure that I follow that real well. Let me give you a song that kind of goes along with this. 1985, we had this wonderful little ballad of the power of mankind. Go ahead and just put this up, would you, Daniel? You remember? We are the world. We're the children. We're the ones to make a better place. And you've got all these people. Oh man, chill bumps. Woo! Okay, yeah. Okay? Go ahead, just kill that. Kill that. Okay. We are the world. We are the children. It's up to us to make this world a better place. So let's start giving. And then you got the you know, you've got all these singers. You've got Michael Jackson, you've got Stevie Wonder, you've got Ray Charles, you've got Whitney Houston, you've got Kenny Rogers. You've got everyone. And they're saying, we're the world, we'll do this. Well, now we are about 37 years or 32 years past that one. How are we doing? World a better place? War stopped all around, peace on earth, goodwill to men, human achievement did it all. Now, don't take my word for it. Let's look at what the writer says. Verses 4 through 7, he's going to express to you and me the ultimate futility of assuming that you and I can make any difference of lasting value if there is only life under the sun. Look at this. Verse 4, he says, what? He goes, generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. He's talking about life and death. Hey, you've got a kid who comes, someone who dies. Kid who comes, someone who dies. So it's like a machine. That's all you've got. Verse 5, he goes on talking about the sun. He says the sun rises and the sun sets. It hurries back where it rises from. So you've got people coming and going. Now you've got the sun coming. Yeah, it's like padding, you can't do it. And then you have this next verse, verse 6. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. It's just the cycles of life. And then verse 7, we have the cycle of rain and evaporation. He says, all streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea is never full. Why? To the place the stream comes from, the clouds, there they return again. And so up and down, life cycle, the sun, the moon. The world keeps chugging after you're gone, as though you are never here. In fact, he's going to make some incredibly startling claims. He's going to talk about this life as though it's almost like, here's the best example I can give you. How many of you in January said, I'm going to get back into shape? Anyone want to admit? No? Okay. So you go to the gym, and what do you see in the gym? People on treadmills. By the way, I have a theory for why they have so many TVs in the weight room. It's because you're on a treadmill, you're running, blood is sweating. Whew, no, hopefully not. You're sweating, you're breathing fast, and you have to distract yourself from the fact you're working hard but going nowhere. Life is far more like Groundhog's Day than any of us are comfortable admitting. Amen? You remember the movie Groundhog's Day? And by the way, we're pulling 80s all through today. Next week I'll go a little older or younger, whatever. But you remember Bill Murray? He gets stuck in this daily time trap. It's Groundhog's Day every day. And finally, after he has learned as much as he can learn, he has studied how to play the piano, he can... Remember the ice sculptures he does with the chainsaw? That was so cool. I looked at my dad, he goes, no. But finally, you remember near the end of the movie, he becomes so depressed with the monotony, the unendingness of life. What does he start to do? He starts to find creative ways to kill himself, because this is all there is. In fact, if we think about the idea that we can make the world a better place, just look at the 20th century. We thought, let's get rid of God. And the most secular countries in the world, the ones that had in many ways gotten rid of God, Red China, Russia, they killed millions of people. Wars did not cease, they began. But we can do it ourselves. And the writer is going to say, if there is nothing beyond this life, understand, you will be forgotten. As someone says, the Alpha Male goes, not me. I'm going to live such an excellent life. I'm going to be such a beast in business. I'm going to build such an empire for myself that people will remember me for generations. Okay, let's read verse 11. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. Quick question. How many of you remember or know about your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents? Anyone? How about this? How many of you know who your great-great-great-grandparents were? Anyone? Great. 2 out of 525. You've proven my points. You will be forgotten in a short period of time. And you say, well, I'll leave money to some place. They'll put a plaque on a school. Centuries from now, that school will most likely not even be there. But I will rule a country. Great. 4,000 years from now, archaeologists may find your name on something and infer your existence. This view does not work. And let's just go a little further here. If this world is all there is, Scientists will tell us, even if something lives to be a billion years old, it is a flash in the pan compared to the existence of the universe. And let's go a step further. If this earth continues to go until its extinction, eventually what are we told this earth is going to do? Burn up. So all the good things you do eventually will be as though they were never done. If there's only life under the sun. Aren't you glad you came to church today? Just warm and fuzzy. But he wants us to have the guts to admit the reality of our worldviews. So now he's going to go into the second one because other people say, okay, fine. Secular humanism doesn't work. They'll then say, okay, so maybe it's meaningless, but I will run to meaning found in pleasure. We call this view hedonism. If you're wanting to write this down, the second one is hedonism. And it simply means that I will find meaning, put this up on screen, in pleasure and the acquisition of stuff. Hey, by the way, if you were to turn on the TV today, what worldview do you see most often promoted? It's all about what you can get, all the pleasures, all the stuff. In fact, you'll watch that commercial today, that car company, and they'll tell you about the car that you deserve. And I love how Solomon blows this view up as well. But some of you are going, I'm not real sure I catch this one. Okay, parents, forgive me. But let's go back to the 80s one more time. Here's another clip that I think gives you a nice picture. Go ahead, Daniel, of hedonism. You guys remember this one? Okay. Kill him. All right, so you've got now material possessions. By the way, that right there is why we don't yet videotape what I do up here, okay? Now, he's going to start blowing up this view as well. Let's look down here at verse 8. He says, all things are wearisome. More than one can say, the eye is never enough of seeing. Is that true? You see, one thing, it's great for the moment, but after a while, it no longer sustains. So what do you have to do? See something else. How many of you men have seen the perfect football game played? It is so incredible that you say, I will never again need to watch another football game. Hasn't happened. Oh, but it was the best ever. I'm curious what's next. The eye never gets enough of seeing, he goes on. Nor the ear is filled or its fill of hearing. We have these things called iPods or iPhones or smartphones or MP3 players. You get that CD and it's just amazing. But then a decade later, what have you done? You've forgotten about it and you've got a whole nother slew of songs. There is never any one thing that will give you the euphoric rush that lasts forever. It is meaningless. And beyond that, let's talk just about reality for a second here. If there is no God, C.S. Lewis makes a profound point. He says, you may enjoy those things. By the way, you can enjoy these things without knowing God. Amen? Christians lose all credibility when they make people out who don't know God to be some sort of bat-wielding hunchbacks who hate life. And that's just not the case. But C.S. Lewis makes an incredible point. He says, here's the problem with this view. You cannot be very thoughtful and live it long. Because if there's nothing beyond you, then what is love other than for just a chemical reaction in your brain? If there's nothing beyond this world telling you that there is something transcendent. In fact, think about this. He says, just you start to hug a child or fall in love with a young lady, men. Or you like listening to music. You can enjoy it only so far as you stop thinking that about the fact that what you're experiencing is not transcendent. It is not real. It's nothing bigger than the chemical reaction you're experiencing in your own brain. So this feeling of love, guys, oh, that's your brain chemistry. If you're just an accident and she's just an accident, then all this is an accidental collision of chemicals in your brain. There is no such thing as love. Start hugging a child. And you just love that child until you begin to realize that this child's nothing more than an accident. I'm nothing more than an accident. The universe just somehow spawned us. And so what I feel for this child is nothing more than a psychochemical reaction. And this child is really nothing more than chemicals that have been given the ability to move. As one scientist, he said, we are nothing more than grown-up germs that know we are grown-up germs. So pleasure loses its pleasurability if you start to think about the fact that what you're enjoying is nothing more than chance, nothing more than happenstance, nothing more than an accident. By the way, Tuesday is what day, gentlemen? Okay, ladies, what is Tuesday? Valentine's Day. Men, write it down. Try writing this kind of card, you know, Hallmark. You go in and you look for the hedonist view, and you look for something that talks about life under the sun, and so you look for that card. By the way, they don't have that card, because it would look something like this. Roses are red, violets are blue, I'm just an accident, and so are you. I love you, baby. I mean, that's not going well. And so he says, there is nothing in this world that will sustain what you desire. Not only that, but what is here. If it's only natural, then what you have, you cannot experience something transcendent such as love. It's just a response to your chemical makeup that is the result of chance. You see why this is so important that we actually push down and pay attention? Let me give you the last one real quick here. Our time's almost up. So he says humanism doesn't work. He says hedonism doesn't work to find meaning. So instead he turns to the gemstone of the 20th century worldviews, the philosophy that was to end all philosophies. And let me just give you a teeny bit of background. You remember a guy named Nietzsche? Okay, you were supposed to read about him. You didn't, or you got cliff notes. Nietzsche was one of the biggest proponents of this thing called nihilism, the idea that there is no value, there is no meaning to the universe. And people found that, while maybe accurate, they found it to be really a bummer of a way to live. And so, in the 40s and 50s, there was this new growth, this new worldview, really proposed by Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus. And they said, here's what we believe. Yes, there is no meaning, but that's too fatalistic. Nihilism doesn't work. So they came up with this thing called existentialism. All right? Here's your third one. Existentialism. Go ahead and put this up on the screen, Daniel. And so existentialism, basically, and this is such a truncated, very small view. We can talk more about this and maybe we'll teach on it later. But basically, existentialism says there is no meaning. By the way, if there's no meaning, there's no absolute truth. You know that phrase? That's existentialism. There is no meaning. This world is cruel and meaningless. But we then have the responsibility to not be cruel, but to stare in the face of ultimate defeat, knowing this universe is going to ultimately destroy us, but we have the responsibility to stare squarely in its face and live courageously, to live morally, to live compassionately. Okay, let me give you a song for this one. And if we played the whole thing, you'd hear more of this. But I think one of the great existential songs was, here it is. We'll just give you a clip from the end. Anyone want to play air guitar right now? This is your moment. Now I want you to listen to the line here. Here it comes. Listen. Nothing really matters. Did you get that? By the way, you guys don't know Ecclesiastes, but you know Queen. We're going to work on this. Okay. Now stay with me. We're almost done here. Here's why this one is so problematic. When you say the world is meaningless, but I will be meaningful in the face of meaninglessness. I will pursue justice in the face of unjust things. I will pursue compassion when there is no compassion. Here's the problem. Now listen, look right at me. Here's the problem. Where do you get the standard for justice, compassion, or any of these other virtues that you aspire to live for if there is no such thing or no standard of what is right or wrong? How can you say this is an unjust world if there is no standard for justice? How can you say this world is not compassionate if there is no standard for compassion? In fact, one author I thought so made such an interesting point. He said, to live this way, to say reality is unjust, but I will live just. Well, let me ask this. A person who says there is no such thing as gravity, even though we all know there is gravity, and chooses then to live as though there is no gravity, what do we call someone who chooses not to live in reality? Insane. Now, I'm not poking holes or throwing rocks at anyone here, but listen to what one of the great authors on this topic made the point. He said, to do this, one must live as though reality is not reality. One must live as though he or she is insane. Because I will live for something that is completely opposite of the way the world actually works. And this is actually what Solomon gets to in verse 17. Look right here. He says, then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom. So he studied up and he began to wrestle through these things. Maybe like so many of you, you're in the books. You're looking at the reality of life and you begin to ask the questions. If there is no God, then what does that lead to? And so he studied. He applied himself to wisdom. And also, look at this now, of madness and folly. Now we're not talking about cuckoo, crazy insanity, but the idea of intentionally living in a way that is opposite of the way the world and universe is. And what does he say, church? I learned that this too was, say this with me, a chasing after the... And so here's the big question. Where do you find meaning? And listen, everyone over the age of 30, you don't have to listen, but if you're under 30, listen to me real carefully, please. I'm looking over here because this is where many of you sit. So you're going, hey, I'm under 30. That's great. Okay, listen. You all have grown up in a world that is devoid of any absolutes. Your grandparents grew up in a world that said there was absolute truth. There was absolute right and wrong. There was morality. There were these standards by which we could live. But our generation and those coming after us are growing up in a world that says there is no absolute truth. Do you believe that? Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that's the truth. But regardless, they have this worldview that says there is no ultimate truth. And they lead lives that are circular and that don't go anywhere. They're on the treadmill and they're looking for value. They're looking for meaning in leaving a legacy, changing the world, collection of pleasures and stuff. And they're finding what ultimately we all will find is that you can do that for only so long before your brain kicks in and says, this too is meaningless. So where do you find meaning? And at least the proposition of this writer is that there is no meaning under the sun. If this is all there is, then we got nothing to live for. Do you understand why there's so much despair in our culture today? And so he then leaves us with this question. And this is the exact same question that the ancient Roman and Greek cultures faced in the first century. They said, we've tried it all. We've followed philosophical worldviews and it has left us with a sense of meaninglessness. And so they finally get to this point. They say, what do we do? How do we make sense of life? How do we find meaning? And they propose, well, if only we could find this thing, this ultimate meaning. And they called it the Logos, the Word. It is the one thing that if it came, we would understand the way that life works and where we fit in it. And so we find the answer, at least proposed in Scripture for meaning, is that there is life beyond the sun. And in John chapter 1, verse 1, John writes these words, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Logos, the meaning, is not found in a philosophic worldview. It is found in a person, Jesus Christ. And as long as I look for meaning under the sun, I can have pleasure, I can have meaningful relationships, I can enjoy things, but I will never find ultimate meaning to life. But it's there if we look above the sun. And the writer's basically going to leave us with this. Look, if your origin has no meaning, family, listen. If you don't hear anything else, listen to this. If your origin has no meaning, if you came from nothing, and there is no God, and if you're going to nothing, if your destiny has no meaning, then have the guts to admit that your life here has no meaning. But if there is a God, and if this world is not all there is, if there is intrinsic value in today because He made it so, if there is true love because He made it so, if there is true compassion, then when you hug a child, you are changing eternity. When you love a person well, you are touching eternity. When you care for the poor, you are changing eternity. When you do your best to create systems that are full of justice and beauty and help people, you are impacting eternity. If nothing has meaning without God, then with God, I will present everything has meaning. And today, when you go home, you're not simply going to your house. You're going to a place that is imbued with meaning. You're going to a place where your children get to hear the Word of God preached, but you're going to be the one just doing it. You're getting to go into a place where you can invite people over so that good community, honest conversation, life-giving discussions can happen. There is meaning now in everything, or there's meaning in nothing, but we can't have it both ways. With God, He imbues life with meaning in everything. Now, I know this doesn't bother some of you. Some of you are kind of going, yeah, I'm already there. In fact, some of you are going to be like, you know, later today, you'll use this. Your wife says, honey, would you mow the lawn? Why? It doesn't really matter. The preacher said so. But if there is a God, then everything you do matters.